Commission on February 2nd, 2005. And I'm going to change the order a little bit until we can get some committee members here, because I want them to hear a couple of the bills that I feel that they really need to have explained to them. And I'm going to drop the Senate Bill 72. Judith?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 72 requires the Department of Transportation to establish protective headgear standards and specifications that conform with national standards and specifications. It's simply adding the term national to describe the type of standards that the department will follow, and according to the department, it brings it into compliance with what the current practices are. We have received a no revenue impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Sure. If you'll give your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Troy Costales. I am the manager for the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. As staff pointed out, in relation to Senate Bill 72, it was ODOT pre-filed bill in reaction to last session when a bill was passed in relationship to requiring headgear for scooters and skaters. In the language from last session, it refers to the standards for the helmets. It refers to a national organization that does not have responsibility for setting standards on helmets. And so, therefore, this bill is asking for a cleanup. So it just generically says that we have the ability to establish by rule reference the national standards and the appropriate entities that set standards for helmets. Bicycle helmets are what are called front-loaded, meaning most accidents of bicycles are frontward, so the helmet is designed for a frontal crash. Scooters and skaters are backwards, so the load is basically in the back of the helmet. And the idea is we want to make sure we point to the right place for the right headgear, and also to provide assistance to parents and other adults that are buying helmets for their kids. And
I think it's really important. In my district alone, there have been two large skating rink added, and so skateboard. And I think that as long as you're going to have communities that are building these, you really need to be doing this at a timely manner. When we built the one in Coos Bay, it was one of the first ones in that whole area, and now that looks like the beginner's program. It's a little one little slope, you know. Just out of curiosity, are there a lot of injuries reported with skateboarders?
Madam Chair, I don't have the numbers in front of me. It's something we can get from Department of Human Services, from the Health Division, in relationship to injuries into the trauma system or hospital care. The last record I saw that there are hundreds, if not thousands, and it's one of the reasons why last session the bill was passed to require the under 16 to wear the protective gear in order to try and mitigate the number of injuries and the severity of them.
Okay. And one of the reasons that I ask you that is that the parks are getting so much bigger, so much deeper slopes, require so much more agility in handling the board. And I'm not saying that they're not just that agile to do it. I just wonder when I see those skateboard parks how they're doing. So, all right. I'm sorry that the committee members are late, but I'm going to always start on time, and I appreciate your being here.
Okay. Thank you, Madam.
And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 72. And I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 73.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 73 waives the reinstatement fee for suspended driving privileges when the Department of Transportation determines that a person was actually in compliance with requirements of the court prior to the effective date of the suspension. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you.
All right, Robin, give your name, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation requested this bill to expand their authority to waive the reinstatement fee when a person's driving privileges have been suspended. This change will improve program consistency in situations where a person has complied with the law and should not be required to pay the $75 reinstatement fee. Senate Bill 73 expands the authority department to waive the $75 reinstatement fee to include a court-related suspension if the department determines that the person complied with court requirements prior to the effective date of the suspension. There are provisions in current statute that allow the department to waive the reinstatement fee when a person's driving privileges are suspended as a result of an error committed by an insurance company or if the Department of Transportation commits an error in issuing a suspension. This bill addresses a similar situation. When a person complies with the court's requirements, the court informs the individual that DMV will be notified so that the suspension will not go into effect. However, in some cases, DMV does not receive the compliance notice from the court prior to the effective date of the suspension. Once DMV receives a compliance notice, DMV can then rescind the suspension, but they do not have the statutory authority to waive the reinstatement fee, even at the request of the court. The department's authority to waive the reinstatement fee is set in statute, and this bill would remedy a situation which annually impacts approximately 200 citizens. I ask the committee to support Senate Bill 73. It positively impacts citizens by allowing the department to waive the reinstatement fee when a person completes the requirements to reverse a court-related suspension prior to the effective date of that suspension. Thank you.
Robin, am I to presume that these 200 people had to pay the $75?
Yes.
Yes. So you had 200 mad people. Angry.
Well, yes. I actually believe we had more requests than, or we had 200 requests, but there were actually more people than that that had to pay that fee. So these people requested that it be waived and had to pay, but there were actually more that paid.
Well, I suppose that's why we have to have so many laws, but see, it would seem to me that it would just be common sense that the department would be able to do that, but I presume that they are not able to do that.
That's right.
Or they wouldn't have brought the... Senate bill. All right. I don't see anybody here besides yourself that's going to testify on this bill. So
thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 73. Senator Metzger called in sick today. I hope that doesn't mean that we've had an outbreak of contagion. All right, let's open the hearing on Senate Bill 74.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 74 allows the Department of Transportation to determine by rule when to issue replacement driver's licenses, permits, or identification cards with a different distinguishing number from the original document being replaced. The measure has no revenue impact. We have received that statement as well as an indication, a statement saying a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Welcome back, Robin.
Thank you. Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Robin Freeman. I'm here representing the Oregon Department of Transportation. Oregon law allows DMV to assign a new driver license number only in situations where a police agency provides the customer with a report stating a person's name or lost driver's license is being used fraudulently. The requirement of providing a police report to DMV regarding the fraudulent use is often a hindrance to the customer and DMV in dealing effectively with fraud. The person may have discovered the fraud by receiving a phone call from a collection agency or being denied credit. The person then works with financial institutions, credit card companies, and perhaps the Social Security Administration to resolve the situation. but today the person cannot present this information directly to DMV and obtain a new driver's license number without a police agency first confirming that the person's name or number is being used fraudulently. Oregon law currently does not allow a person with an identification card to be issued a new number under any circumstances. As a result, citizens with a legitimate need for a new driver's license or ID card number are unable to get one or delayed in getting one. This bill replaces the narrowly defined language in statute with the authority for DMV to adopt rules defining when a new number may be issued and the documentation that a person must submit to receive a new number. This allows DMV's customers to prevent evidence of fraudulent use of their personal information directly to DMV, which allows DMV to be as responsive to their needs as the financial institutions, credit card companies, and the Social Security Administration. In addition, this bill provides the same processes for issuance of a new number, whether it is on a driver's license or an ID card. This bill expands opportunities for DMV to help in curbing fraud by making it easier for citizens with a justifiable reason to obtain a new driver's license or ID card number. DMV will be able to move to more efficiently expose fraud to authorized users of DMV's records by showing that a particular number is no longer valid. I ask the committee to support Senate Bill 74. This bill amends current law to improve DMV's ability to serve citizens of Oregon in the area of fraud. It gives DMV the authority to adopt rules defining when a new number or on driver's licenses and ID cards may be used. And this bill allows DMV to accept evidence other than a police report from citizens with a valid need for a new number on their driver's license or ID card. Thank you.
Robin, is the process pretty much the same except that you wouldn't have to go through the police?
We don't have a the process would be the same except that it would involve you bringing information directly to DMV. So they would then look at the information that you were bringing them. Perhaps that would be your bank statements or a credit report, something of that nature that showed, or probably maybe both of those items and Social Security information, a letter from the Social Security Administration showing that your number or your name was being used fraudulently. So we would be inspecting the documentation instead of the police. That would be the difference.
The bill uses the term fraud, but is this the same as identity theft?
That's a good question. Not always. Sometimes a name is being used fraudulently, but there isn't any theft involved, I would imagine. But let me get back to you and get you some more information on that.
Okay.
I don't necessarily think it would always be the same thing.
Well, let's see if we have any questions by our committee members. Any questions? Nope. All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Reverend. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 74. Members of the committee, I started in a little bit different order. We heard Senate Bill 72, and you have the testimony in front of you, and Senate Bill 73 and 74. And so now we'll go back to Senate Bill 373, and I'll turn it over to Judith.
Can you open the next session or the public hearing for this?
I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 373.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 373 allows certain employees. And in the background, I listed specifically the types of employees that would be included in this measure, who provide educational services to request the Department of Transportation to use the address of the employee's employer instead of the employee's residence address on records maintained by the department. You do also have in front of you a dash one amendment. And that amendment deletes language in the measure regarding personal contact with these are folks, educational services being provided to correctional institution, folks in correctional institutions, both those sorts, as well as, you know, in the juvenile system and perhaps maybe the psychiatric hospital. It simply leaves the language as those who provide educational services to the specified population. It adds to the definition of an employee who provides educational services to include those who provide instruction or services related to instruction of a subject usually taught in elementary school, secondary school, or a community college. And it deletes employees who work for specifically a school district. If you look on the measure if you look on page 2 of the of Senate Bill 373, beginning on line 40, it's specifying there the definition of who would be included in here, and under sub A on line 40, you see it's a school district, those who work for a school district, an educational service district, or a community college district, and the amendment, the dash one amendments, would delete the school district employee but leave the rest of that line. We have not yet received a fiscal revenue statement on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right, I'll call to the podium Tricia Smith, Kathy Bonofsky, and Kathleen Adamson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith, and I'm the Government Relations Specialist of the Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents nearly 20,000 education professionals who work in a wide variety of settings in Oregon's Head Start agencies, K-12 school districts, education service districts, community colleges, and parks and recreation districts. They are classified and certified education professionals who perform every non-management function in schools, from teaching our students directly to making sure that the environment in which they are taught is safe and secure. With me today are two of our members, Kathleen Adamson and Kathy Bonofsky, who work for the Willamette Education Service District here in Salem. Most of our members work for K-12 school districts in typical school settings, but some of them, like Ms. Adamson and Ms. Bonofsky, work in very non-traditional settings where their personal safety can be at risk. Their job is to teach or provide other educational services to children and adults who are incarcerated or otherwise committed to state facilities, or who provide instructional services in the homes of clients. They work for education service districts and for community colleges that have contracted with state agencies to provide these educational services. Employees like Kathleen, who provide education to children and adults in state-operated facilities, include those working in adult correctional facilities, Oregon Youth Authority facilities such as McLaren, and the Oregon State Hospital Forensics Unit. Other employees, like Kathy, provide education services to children in their homes as part of state and federal early intervention programs and must use their personal vehicles to make evaluation and other visits in the home. While their jobs are different from employees of the Department of Human Resources or Corrections or the Oregon Youth Authority, the settings and the clients with whom these education professionals work are not different, nor are the risks that they face. For many years, the legislature has recognized that public employees working in these situations face personal risk, and as a result of their jobs, and have attempted to provide them some anonymity by shielding them from the requirement to disclose their residence address on their motor vehicle division records. Rather than listing their residence address on records such as their driver's license or their vehicle registration, ORS 802-250 allows public employees in these specific situations to list their employer's address as their address of record. The statute has been modified over time as the legislature became aware of different types of employees that are working in these same types of situations. As you can see, the list includes employees who work as correction officers, police officers, parole and probation officers, employees of the Department of Human Services who have personal contact with clients or patients, and employees of certain other agencies whose duties require them to have personal contact with clients. Senate Bill 373 was drafted very narrowly, or what we attempted to draft very narrowly, to address a gap in the protection provided by ORS 802-250 by extending it to employees who are providing education services in the same high-risk situations. However, as originally drafted, the bill extended these protections more broadly than we intended. So an amendment was drafted, the Dash 1 Amendment, in hope to correct that. Unfortunately, after I have reviewed the Dash 1 Amendment, it's just a bit too narrow in that it doesn't include special education services provided by people like Ms. Vonogofsky in the homes of clients. She will explain what she does in a moment, but those are provided to children age birth to 5 before they enter the school setting, and they are provided in home. And so she'll tell you some more about that in just a moment. We do, however, want to be sure that this bill is drafted as it is intended, and that is to provide protection to employees in these high-risk situations, not to teachers in a standard classroom. That's not the intent. We were hoping the Dash 1 Amendment would get us there. We're very close, but not quite. I have contacted the Willamette Education Service District, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Department of Education. All of these about this bill, all of these agencies support the bill. As the person who brought this issue to your attention, I would ask that you would now give your attention to Ms. Adamson so she can tell you her experience that brought this to us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Adamson, and I'm an employee of the Willamette Educational Service District here in Salem. Although Willamette ESD is my employer for the past 10 years, I have worked as an instructional assistant teaching students who are patients at the Oregon State Hospital. For the first 6 years, I worked with younger children who were mostly civilly committed, but since then I have been working with the forensic unit with older children. Students. Today I work in the Equest Adult Program, which provides mandated education instructions to patients 18 to 21 years old. Some of my students are in the process of adjudication and are placed at the state hospital temporarily for evaluation and treatment, and others are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Because of my work environment, I am careful about my personal life and my personal safety. However, last year, the actions of a patient made me aware of how easy it is for anyone to find out my personal information, including my resident address, and how vulnerable I was, and this caused me to be. He informed me of information he had been able to learn about me just from observing my car license plate and watching me work at my computer in the classroom. I decided I need to know how much information there was out there about me. So I did an internet search of my name. I was shocked to see how easy it was for someone to get my home address. In talking with coworkers, I heard firsthand accounts of other staff members, Oregon State Hospital, harassed by patients after getting their home addresses, and was advised I should take the DMV option to use my employer's address on my records. I then began a systematic effort to remove any of my personal information from publication. I changed my phone number of 25 years and had it unlisted. I opened a P.O. box and had all my mail sent there. I went to the Marion County Assessor's Office and was allowed to change my property records to reflect my P.O. box address rather than my residence because of the nature of my work. I was also allowed to change my voter's registration address to the P.O. box, again because of the hazards associated with my workplace. But when I went to the Motor Vehicle Department office to change my vehicle driving records, I was told I could not, that I didn't fall in the categories of the law. Even though I worked directly with the patients and alongside other of the state hospital forensic unit who provide are receiving this protection, I could not because my employer is an education service district, and they are not included in ORS 802.250. I'm sure that we were not included because of no one thought of it before. I didn't think of it until an incident arose to bring to my attention. Now I understand how important this is for someone in my circumstance. I hope you will help us protect ourselves by giving us the protection others have in ORS 802.250. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Bonagofsky, and I'm an employee of the Willamette Education Service District here in Salem. In my work as an intake specialist, I provide initial evaluations of children ages birth through five who may need special education services provided under state and federal early childhood intervention programs. The nature of my work requires me to make personal visits with clients and their families in their homes. I am required by my employer to use my own personal vehicle in these visits. Because my work places me in situations where I have personal contact with clients that can have serious family issues and I must use my own car, I feel that my personal safety would be better protected if I can shield my resident address on my DMV records. My situation is not unique among employees providing these kinds of specialized education services through ESDs. And I'm sure if the legislature had known about us before, we would have already been included in the statutes. We hope you will correct this oversight now by passing Senate Bill 373. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, Tricia, and Kathy. Kathleen, I want to ask you, when you did your search of your personal information, did you just happen to type in your phone number on Google?
No, I just typed in my name.
Well, you know...
And they came up with, for so much money, which I paid, and they have everything, because it's all, you know, we're so intermingled with the Internet now, that detective sites will give out your name, your address, and everything. Now, I have changed that to where they can't, I'm not on there anymore, because a lot of it comes from public records.
Well, if you buy a washer or dryer, they ask you to please give you your phone number, and if you leave it that way, then MapQuest does a lovely little direction to your house with a star by it, unless you remove it from the public record, which I think people really do need to know about that. I think they would be very surprised if they put in almost any personal information that they would find out how much people knew about them. That was on the Internet. Mm-hmm. That was accessible publicly. All right. Well, I'm going to thank you and call up now Robin Freeman from the Department of Transportation.
Good afternoon again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Transportation. Excuse me. Oregon law has a provision that allows certain types of employees to use their work address and DMV records in lieu of their home address. That law is about 20 years old and started with giving this option to police officers. At that time, DMV records were public records, and officers were concerned that their home address was accessible to anyone for any purpose. Over time, the law has been expanded and now covers 12 groups of employees who can optionally use their work address. Approximately 7,400 employees from these 12 groups have exercised this option. In 1997, Oregon adopted the provisions of the Federal Driver Privacy Protection Act. Since then, the name and address on DMV records have not been public record. However, there are exceptions in that law that allow any government agency and just about any business to access name and address for a variety of reasons. While the name and addresses are no longer available to any person who walks into a DMV office, that information is available to many government and businesses, business concerns, so a degree of risk does exist. This bill seeks to add employees who provide certain educational services to the list of employees eligible to use their work address in lieu of their home address. We understand that the intent was to add employees who provide educational services to mental health care clients of the Department of Human Services. Unfortunately, the language in the bill as drafted is broader than that. We also understand that amendments will be introduced today to narrow the definition. We have two additional suggestions that we believe will help limit the bill to the target employees and that will ensure ODOT can administer the bill effectively. I provided Ms. Smith with this information. We want to ensure the committee knows the implications of using a work address on DMV records. First, it may affect ODOT's distribution of monies to the counties. Of the total county share of monies, each county receives a portion equal to the number of vehicles registered in that county as of December 31 of the previous year. If a person works in a county different from where they live, it will affect the percentage. Secondly, DEQ compliance may be affected if the employee's home address is in the DEQ testing area, but the work address is not. And lastly, DMV records themselves are less accurate. DMV records are widely used by government and private businesses. A higher percentage of work addresses makes the database less valuable to those groups. When DMV needs to contact a licensee to notify the person of an upcoming license expiration or to send a suspension notice, for example, we mail to the work address with the expectation that the employer will give the mail to the employee. DMV can implement this bill as written, but we would like to work with the bill sponsor to focus on the intended group. Thank you.
Questions? All right. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks.
Next, I'll call Misty Pensa. Misty passes. All right. Before I close the public hearing, though, I'm presuming that the sponsors of the bill are willing to work with ODOT and get the intended number of people.
Madam Chair, Tricia Smith. Yes, we have been working with DMV. We will continue to do that. I can't promise that we will come to agreement on how narrow the bill should be. Our concern is not making it so narrow that some of our people fall out of it. And as long as it covers everyone who is in the situations that we've described, then we're very happy. We don't want to add people we have inadvertently in situations other than those described. So we'll work very carefully with Legislative Council and committee staff to assure that the bill does what we intend.
Not a question, just a comment or statement. I assume our committee administrator will be working with these individuals regarding whatever amendments are going to be submitted for drafting.
That's right. In fact, I worked with them on the dash ones you have before you.
Okay. I also have a clarification of one that's already existing that doesn't have a specific definition. So I think it would be worth putting that in, and we'll give that to our administrator afterwards.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Starr, any comments or questions? All right. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373. Committee, I just want to remind you of the February the 11th. Judith, will they soon be getting an agenda and everything worked out? You're still working on the
details. That's right.
The details.
We're going to get that figured out as soon as possible, so we can get that on there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very, very good. Anything to come before the committee? All right. We're working it out where you would be coming from, Eugene.
Oh, great.
And the rest of us would be going the fastest way possible. Okay. All right. Well, if there's no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.